The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Nicolas Obregón. He's just put out a new Inspector Iwata novel. It's called Sins as Scarlet. He joins us on the telephone in Los Angeles. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back again.
Wow, you really threw me here, Nick. The previous book, the first book, your debut, was set in Japan, and you pulled a fast one on me in this one. Wow. Tell us how this happened.
Well, so because the second book is set in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are probably a few branches to this tree, but the oldest one is just simply because I'd always wanted to write something set in Los Angeles. I mean, like many authors, I kind of grew up with this city. Movies and a million movies and a million books, and so it's kind of always been part of the kind of architecture of my imagination, I guess. So there was always that kind of present. But then, yeah, I mean, I knew I had to write a sequel. I had a contract for two Inspector Iwata books at the time, and I knew also that he was bicultural, that he'd grown up both in Japan and in Southern California, much in the same way where I grew up in the UK, but also in Spain. And so I just thought that this would be a great opportunity to, as you say, throw a curveball and to take him out again of his comfort zone. I knew he had to continue being an outsider. And after the first book, which, you know, spoiler alert, he catches the bad guy and he survives, I knew I didn't want him to maintain or be the hero, the kind of the victorious hero. I needed him to carry on being the outsider. And so by taking him away from Japan, and also he's kind of done with it at that point, moving him across the ocean to L.A. and having him now be a simple private detective, I knew that that would create all the barriers and the kind of outsider element I would need for Iwata to continue being Iwata. And then lastly, and sorry, it's a very roundabout answer, but lastly, because I always knew that L.A. Is this place where, I mean, certainly in the U.K., people were saying to me, well, it's great, you know, Blue Light Yokohama is set in Japan and it's exotic and the rest of it and nobody knows about that place. But don't set it in L.A., don't set the sequel in L.A. because everybody knows L.A. And that, I think, always kind of, it maybe irritated is a strong word, but missed me slightly because I thought, not that I'm any expert on the place, but I always kind of instinctively knew that they think they know L.A., and that there was a rift between the kind of storied version of this city and then what I have actually seen in the kind of 3 years of living here. And that's where Sins of Scarlet is set, in that rift between the kind of the trope, kind of Netflix version of L.A. where lots of rich white people have a marvelous time, and then what's actually here. So, yeah.
You took that as a bit of a challenge, didn't you, that they said, oh, don't set it in Los Angeles. Everybody writes about Los Angeles. Robert Craze, Michael Connelly, all these people, the classics, Raymond Chandler, they're all set in Los Angeles. Don't do that. You can't do it. And it was kind of like Clayton Kershaw being told, no, you can't throw that curveball for the third strike. And sure enough, you did it. And,
well, I mean, I'll take that comparison. I don't know much about baseball, but I will take that.
Should I have used a football comparison, a soccer?
That would have worked for me, but I do appreciate that you called it football first.
All right. Well, I think we probably should tell them a little bit about Blue Light Yokohama because anyone who's read this book thinks maybe they know a little bit about Iwata, but you actually give us so much more of his backstory in the second book. Can you give us just a little snapshot of the first book?
So Blue Light Yokohama, which is set in the year 2011, follows Inspector Iwata's journey as he joins the Tokyo Homicide Division. And he is a replacement, and that's something that everybody kind of lets him know. And so he is given the case, which nobody really wants, of an entire family who were murdered in their home, which is loosely based on a frankly unbelievable true case which happened in the year 2000, which is kind of Japan's version of the kind of the JonBenet Ramsey case. Mm. I mean, everybody knows that case there. So that's a brutal case which almost cost him his life in Blue Lap, Yokohama. And by the end of that book, he's done with Japan and he needs to start again. He kind of needs to get away from his ghost. So now shifting into Sins of Scarlet, it's 5 years on. And like I say, he's working as a private detective. And he's kind of like a Michelin chef working in like a Burger King or something, right? Like mm-hmm. he's just doing missing person cases and cheating spouses. But it's a living. And it's kind of beneath his skills. But you know, for him, it's a simple, quiet life. And now his demons are behind him, or of course, so he thinks.
Uh-huh.
Once again, he's dragged down the rabbit hole into an odyssey of murder and missing souls and through the underbelly of Los Angeles and finally out into the borderlands of northern Mexico.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, I've been joined in the Book Nook today by Nicolas Obregón, and his new novel, an Inspector Iwata novel, is Sins as Scarlet. And you talked about the first book, Blue Light Yokohama. In that book, Iwata has some serious issues. He's really had some substance abuse problems. And in this new book, we can tell that something's different because he pulls out a beer and he's drinking non-alcoholic beer and he's not popping pills. Something's different. But this is a guy with a lot of baggage, a lot of emotional baggage. He's had some really bad things happen in his life from the time he was born. And you go back and give us a lot of the backstory in this new book, don't you?
Mm. Yeah, I think that came out of the fact that in its kind of first, kind of earliest conception, Blue Light Yokohama was just going to be this one enormous odyssey, and it was going to kind of explore his entire kind of history, whilst at the same time juggling a kind of present-day mystery. And I found it was just unworkable in this one book. It became this enormous kind of Iliad. Mm. Of a book. And then this was around the time I was trying to get an agent anyway, and so I thought that it would make sense to split it up into a trilogy, both in terms of, you know, brass tacks, but then also the fact that I thought there are so many stories here to be had with this character and his world. And so because I'm interested in writing about vulnerability, because I'm interested in people and certainly segments of our society which are maligned or marginalized, I really, as a writer, want to get into that space of the way people deal with pain, maybe the lies that they tell to others, and the way in which they kind of excuse things to themselves. And so, yeah, rightly, as you say, in the second book, his coping mechanisms have improved, and the pain is kind of well buried. But when an old ghost comes calling, it kind of threatens to reopen all of these old wounds and force him to confront, what has always been there. And in the end, it's kind of the past and the present are always at war inside Iwata. And so that's kind of the battle that he faces, as well as the kind of the real one. So there's an existential threat inside him as well as the kind of present day one.
We can't talk about who this old ghost is because it's just too delicious. And it's a client that Iwata cannot possibly turn down as much as he might wish to. Mm-hmm. And he also, he's in a position here where we get to find out a lot about his mother. And we might not have liked his mother very much early on from the things we heard about what she did early on. But in this book, you go back and you take us to 1975 and we get to see her in these extended flashbacks and we find out that she wanted to be a writer. I thought that was so cool. You had fun with that, didn't you?
I really did, yeah. Well, I think, so Iwata's mother, Nozomi, she was going to be far more present in the first book. This is going back to what I was saying about kind of exploring all of the different facets of his life, but not really being able to do that within the framework of a debut novel. And so what we're left with in the first book is a mother who, although it's obvious, has things going on. And although it's obvious, you know, it's obvious that she's struggling. Essentially, we only really see her once, which is to abandon her son at a bus station.
Mm-hmm.
And so, by hook or by crook, that's who she is in that story. And it always kind of left a bitter taste in my mouth that we didn't really get to kind of understand why or understand her, or even that she would be relevant to the reader. But also, I think, you know, one's relationship with one's mother or parents, well, you know, that relationship is such a blueprint for everything else that's to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found it interesting that it's very rare that we look at the detective's background. There will often be bereavement or loss or pain. That's a standard trope. It's almost, you know, obligatory. But we very rarely kind of see, you know, what they do on a Sunday afternoon whilst having lunch with their mother, and what if it's not an ideal relationship, but they're both still trying. So in this second book, I knew I wanted to get into, okay, so in the first book we see what's happened to him in his past, and now in the second book we see kind of why. And as you say, you know, to give emotional context as well as just backstory. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's the way people deal with their emotions and the way they deal with their pain that interests me far more than stuff like, you know, a killer's calling card or the amount of blood on the floor. You know, those things, I'm not having a go at any kind of trope in crime fiction. I don't think there are any wrong answers. But the space that interests me is the kind of the humanity or the lack thereof. And so, yeah, in a very roundabout, that's kind of, that's why I knew that I wanted Nozomi to be not only more present in this book, but also for her to kind of be a second protagonist.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm talking to Nicolas Obregón about his new novel, Sins as Scarlet. We're going to take a little break and come back with another segment of the Book Nook. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and we record the programs in advance these days. And during that first segment of my interview with Nicolas, something happened that's never happened before. They had a fire drill, and they had to evacuate the building for about 15 minutes. But you couldn't tell, could you, because of the beauty of digital editing. Let's continue now with my conversation with Nicolas. Well, we certainly get a better understanding of his attempts to deaden his psychic pain. You're relentless as far as exposing all the psychic pain he's feeling, and you never stop. Even at the end of the book, where you just pile on a little bit more. It's like, oh man, it's like, how does this guy get up in the morning?
Right.
Can we talk at all about the hummingbird, or is that something you want to save for people that have finished the book?
So the hummingbird, essentially, that was kind of the spark moment for this book. I mean, it has many mothers, as books always will. But the kind of the spark moment, I think, was about 2.5 years ago when I first moved out here. And I knew that I had a contract to write a sequel, and I knew that I wanted to set it in Los Angeles primarily. But I didn't really know, you know, my way into that. And then I was reading about remains found in the U.S.-Mexico desert. And in 2009, a man without a name was found dead in the desert near the border, and inside his pocket there was a dead hummingbird. And there was something just so omen-like about this image that it just sort of felt like it meant something, or at least it made me question who he was. You know, who was he? Who was this man? What did he want? What was he hoping for? What kind of a life was he hoping to lead? And certainly I knew that hummingbirds in certain indigenous cultures are a kind of a messenger between the living and the dead. And so I knew that, or I felt that, you know, on some level, this guy certainly believed in good luck. And in that moment, I kind of realized that Sins of Scarlet would be a book about Inspector Iwata walking in a world of missing migrants, you know, transgender people, undocumented people, homeless people, essentially the marginalized underbelly, and that it would lead to Los Angeles. And in the end, the man with the dead man with the dead hummingbird didn't quite make it into the book, but certainly in its earliest form, the hummingbird was going to be very present. And in fact, I thought it would form part of the title somehow. But by the end of it, it almost felt like it was wrong somehow to use it. So I kind of left him and his memory where it was. But certainly that kind of facelessness or the powerlessness of just dying in a desert, you know, 10 years ago, and nobody knowing what happened to you, there is something about that kind of mystery which goes beyond any kind of book or movie. It's a real thing that's happening every year in the thousands, and it's going up, not down. And it's a reality that won't ever, no matter how big a war, no matter how militarized a border becomes, so long as there is money in a place, people will go to that source. And that's why the opening quote in the book is, for where the river runs, people will drink. So that's kind of the heart of the novel, really.
We live in a world with dwindling resources, surging populations, wars, famines, climate change. People are traveling, trying to get to other places where they can have better lives. It's a big issue in a lot of countries. I'm not sure what your passport says, but I know you've lived in Spain, you've lived in the UK, you've lived in Japan and the United States. You've seen what an issue immigration is in some of these countries, and particularly here where we have a president who's saying he's willing to shut down the government if he can't get funding for his border wall. I think anyone who reads your book, Sins of Scarlet, is going to really be laser focused on the issue of immigration over the Mexican border.
Well, I mean, that's something where a lot of people have said to me in the UK, where the book is already out, because it comes out next week here in the US, but a lot of people back there said, this book is very prescient, you know, it's amazing that it's come out now where it's so relevant in terms of what's happening politically, both here in the US and in the UK, in lots of places, really. But the reality is that I wrote this book about 3 years ago. So these issues, you know, whilst certainly were on the horizon, they were also clear and present at the time, because the truth is that they're not new. And so, yeah, we do live in that world, as you quite rightly say. I think when somebody offers you simple solutions, which are summed up in a soundbite, when they sound good, and it makes perfect sense that they'd be willing to believe them. It makes perfect sense that human beings would want to believe the black and white answer in a grey world. But I think the truth is that you can only really, you know, we have a responsibility to do some due diligence when somebody offers us simple answers in a complicated world. And that's true here, and that's certainly true in the UK. And that's true everywhere. And so I think when you start looking at what it actually means, right? Let's make it hard for people to come here without documents. Okay, so what does making it hard mean? Well, if we're living in a world where children under the age of one are literally put in cages in a repurposed Walmart, and you find yourself saying, well, that's not great, but ... then if you genuinely believe that children, whatever their parents have done, you know, are collateral enough to put in a cage, you know, then we found ourselves in a bunker mentality where no matter what happens, I refuse to be wrong. I refuse to feel silly about the choice I made. And so I think, like, that's something where it is difficult. Nobody wants to say, hey, you know what, like, maybe this isn't great. We see this every day in the UK. I mean, only yesterday did we find out that the head of state may possibly lose her job, as if there is anybody else in that country who has a better solution. And so Sins of Scarlet, sorry, it's gone very political, but Sins of Scarlet wasn't necessarily a political book. It wasn't necessarily an indictment of Donald Trump or anti-immigration or anything like that. It's simply, I've lived here for the past 3 years. I've gone to Mexico. I've mentored inside youth prisons, effectively, in LA County. I've spoken to people. I've seen the sights and I've smelled the smells. And I just wanted to put that in the book. Now, I'm not saying I'm an expert or any kind of beacon, but it is what I saw. And so I just, although it's fiction, I wanted my detective to respect the tropes that crime fiction demands and tip my cap at Chandler and all of the greats that I loved growing up and that I read kind of religiously, because that version of LA is something that is beloved around the world. But at the same time, I wanted to reject them and to write about the LA that I feel is actually here, which is that, sure, there are people who are on the make, and sure, there are kind of professionally beautiful people and people who are obsessed with furthering their own brand and the rest of it, but there are also many, many people who are not that. There are also many, many people who are just trying to get by, and sure, there are lots of very wealthy people having wonderful lives, but there are also plenty of people who are in utter, utter desperation. And so I wanted, as I say, Iwata, to kind of walk in that rift between the two kind of vast disparities. And there are disparities in London, and there are disparities in London, in Paris and Madrid and the rest of it. But I just feel like LA is kind of the world capital of it. It's so exaggerated. It's so vast. Skid Row is a five-minute walk from Bunker Hill. And, you know, in Skid Row, you literally may see a man dying in the street. You know, some of the things I've seen there going in, you know, for the past 2 years, your eyes pop out of your head, but you are 5 minutes away walk from a guy with a $10,000 briefcase queuing up for, a sushi burrito, you know, and he's talking about the stock market and the rest of it. It's just, it really is a writer's dream in a way. So yeah, that was a very long-winded answer.
Yeah, well, this is the second book this year that I've read that spent a lot of time on Skid Row. The other one was the new book by Ivy Pacoda. I don't know if you read that one, but yeah, Los Angeles, when I'm there, I'm always amazed at the disparity where you'll have a guy in his $200,000 car talking on his cell phone, waiting for the light to change, and then right off to the right, there's a guy sleeping on a piece of cardboard.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that the fact that that's there in and of itself isn't what shocked me coming here. It's more the fact that the scale of it, you know, that same image happens in London too, but it's just that there isn't a 50-block, you know, area where literally thousands of people are living in tents. Well, certainly if there were that, then people wouldn't just go, well, this is bad, but what can you do? It's that kind of that feeling of, well, that's just the lay of the land, the kind of the resignation. I think that's kind of what's most shocking. And I think that's why, as you say, it's the second book you've read this year. And I hope there will be more, because I think that space in Los Angeles where people do live, where people do exist, is largely overlooked by all of the stories that we tend to be given about LA. They tend to be this particular kind of type of story about a particular kind of person. And it's not that everybody is, you know, living in Beverly Hills, but often it will be kind of very wealthy white people or criminals. You know, there's not going to be a story about a 50-year-old Guatemalteco woman who's, taking her shopping home on the bus in East LA. You just don't see that. And the reality is that there are far more of her than there are, billionaires up in Bel Air. And so, and I'm not saying that this is the definitive version of Los Angeles that we see in my book, but it's just the version that I feel I actually saw, that I actually did see and smell and the rest of it. Because I think there is this kind of mirage that people, certainly in the UK, kind of get, which is that it's all going to be famous people. It's all going to be people with plastic surgery, and that the waiters are all trying to overhear anecdotes so that they can put them in a screenplay. Surfers waiting for the big one, and private detectives sleeping in their car. And those people are here, but they're such a small kind of sliver of this entire kind of technicolor dreamcoat that is this city, where thousands of languages, thousands of cuisines, people from all over the world come here, and every time a pothole is fixed or a child is cared for or a coffee is served, you know, more often than not, the person doing that is not from here, just as it is in London. And so for me, it's this weird thing where, although there are palm trees and I'm thousands and thousands of miles away from my home in London, and it looks and talks and walks differently, there is this kind of almost familiar energy here. So that's that was why it was really beautiful to write Sins of Scarlet, whilst at the same time it was hard to see the things that you see when you want to go looking for them.
Well, I'd like to note, since you're talking about beautiful, that the book is beautifully written, and there's certain phrasings where you, as a reader, you read it and you just go, I'm going to go back and read that about 10 more times. Like here's one. Back on Descanso Drive, the palm fronds against the sunset moved like flies, drowning in honey. Mm. That's good stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, we need to talk about the murder. Okay, sure. Can we talk about the murder that gets him interested, well, kind of forces him to get involved in the situation? Can we talk about what happened?
Absolutely. So he's given a case. A person comes to his private investigations agency and, as you say, kind of makes him an offer he can't refuse, which is he has to take this case because it matters to the person deeply. And so he is investigating the murder of a transgender woman who's found dead on some train tracks behind Skid Row. And what's happened is there's been a cursory investigation by the police, but there aren't really any leads, and they've assumed that it is a sexual financial transaction that's gone wrong, and there aren't really any witnesses. And so quite quickly she's figured for another cold case, and she's kind of put in the filing cabinet. But as Iwata starts to investigate, he comes to the conclusion fairly early on that she may not be the only transgender woman who this has happened to. And it goes back to what I was saying about he is dragged into this kind of underbelly where there are cities within cities in LA, and you will have an entirely different experience on the same street corner at 8 a.m. versus 8 p.m. And so it's this kind of, I think my editor used the phrase smog and noir, which I liked a lot, which I was like, I'm going to steal that. But that's kind of, yeah, so that's the crime that he starts to look into. But then as he starts to look into it, he quickly realizes that this is not just, you know, another scenario where, well, your husband's cheating on you, I'm very sorry, here are the photographs, and that will be, you know, $1,200, please. This is something where it's people's lives. And simply because of who they are, they may be falling kind of under the radar. And so because he has this skill set, he is driven to find the truth, as ever he should be.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined on the telephone in Los Angeles by Nicolas Obregon. We are discussing his second novel. It's another Inspector Iwata novel called Sins of Scarlet. We had Nick on for his debut, Blue Light Yokohama, and these are fabulous novels. If you have not discovered them, I highly recommend them. Now this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm talking to Nicolas Obregon, who is British-Spanish. He holds dual nationality. He grew up in London and Madrid, and he has worked at a number of occupations. He's been a steward at sports stadiums, an editor in legal publishing, a travel writer. He fell in love with Japan while he was on assignment there for a magazine. Currently, he lives with his wife in Los Angeles. A lot of the story takes place south of the border in a city along the border in Mexico. This is not a real city, but it sounds like a lot like Juarez.
Right, right. It's it's a composite of two or three different places. And the reason I fictionalized it is because whilst all of the things that are seen in the book are versions of things that do happen. Mexico is a massive country, and it's not all, cartels and beheadings and the rest of it. In fact, that's just one reality there. You know, it would be like if you turned on the news and saw the Las Vegas mass shooting and thought, well, that's America. You know, that is America on that day in that place, but it's not America in its entirety. And so I knew I had to fictionalize the place if I was going to make it a kind of seat of malevolence. And so he is dragged into this very dangerous town, which certainly circa 2010, Juarez inspired it, if that's the right word, along with one or two other cities. But for me, in a lot of ways, that was fun to write, again, if that's the right word, because of my Spanish background and because I could go there and speak to people in their own language. And when you do talk to real people, you know, even if you're just in a taxi from the airport, the guy will just throw out this, you know, pearl, and you think, wow, that was worth a trip alone. So, so living in L.A. and going to Mexico and having spent time in Japan, I feel that if you're actually in the place, the smells and the sights and the sounds, it's a lot easier to please the reader with beautiful writing or just kind of clear detail if you yourself have actually kind of spent the afternoon, you know, taking photos and talking to people. And, on a personal note, it's just an excuse to travel, frankly. So, I really can't complain.
When you hear one of those pearls, do you scribble it down quickly in the back seat of the cab? Do you?
I do. I find myself repeating it to myself mentally if I can't write it down or if it would be too obvious. But I often, because I do have this kind of neuroses of coming up with some fantastic line and then going to bed and then waking up the next day and it's gone forever. That gives me shudder. It makes me shudder just thinking about that. So, yeah, I do.
We had a crime novelist on the other day from Iceland, and he told me that in Iceland, they might have one murder a year, sometimes none, which makes it kind of tough if you're writing murder mysteries. Now, Los Angeles, there's no shortage of murders. And I'm remembering now about 10 years ago, I was in Los Angeles and they were going to have a birthday party for Michael Connelly at a restaurant by the old train station down there. And I got a ride across L.A. with Robert Kraes in his SUV. And as we were driving along, he pointed out scenic things like the police headquarters, and he'd point over somewhere and he'd go, now he says, that would be a great place to hide a body.
right.
As you're going around LA, is that the kind of thing that you imagine? Do you think about stuff? Because you really know LA, it seems like, really well. I mean, you're taking us on a tour here, and we're eating all the food. You're a inspector. Man, he's got a great palate.
He does. Well, yeah, I mean, I moved here in the spring of 2016, having been here quite a few times before. I first came in 2008, and so even in that kind of time frame, LA really has changed, as all big cities have. But when I came here, I couldn't drive, and so being a typical Londoner, you don't really need to drive; you take public transport. So a guy on $150,000 a year will still be on the subway. The mayor of London may well take the tube or may well take his bike to work. So, but obviously coming to LA, that's, it's a different kettle of fish. But that meant that for about 18 months, I was, walking all over the city, and people will tell you, you can't walk LA, and, you know, you really can. I've done it. Whether it's nice or not is a different matter. But yes, certainly. I mean, I think a part of writing is location scouting. Especially if you're not writing in your hometown. I mean, I could write 15 different crime novels in London, but there is also just a kind of a small thrill when you walk past an alleyway and you walk back again. You think, hold on, what was that? And you go down the alleyway and you discover something. That's always, I mean, I guess location scouting for me is part of the research process, but certainly Skid Row and the train tracks that lead into First Street Bridge, and that entire kind of industrial area, which is between downtown LA and then crossing over the river, it's this kind of no man's land, and it's all concrete. And so there's this weird kind of demi-monde between the industrial, but then you've got sort of Belle Epoque architecture. So it's as if a bridge has been transported from like 1930s Paris or Budapest or something and just plunked in the middle of this warehouse area where people are living in the street. So that's kind of those kind of idiosyncrasies and quirks of a city. The ones that often get overlooked, you know, I don't spend much time talking about, I don't know, the Hollywood Hills sign, for example. Or, I mean, I do talk about Hollywood, but it's not with this kind of warm, misty-eyed affection. And certainly when I've brought family members and friends to, when they've come over to visit, I mean, it's not that we won't go to Hollywood Boulevard or Universal Studios and the rest of it, but you always sense this kind of almost this vague disappointment. You know, when you walk along Hollywood, that the reality of it is got nothing to do with this image that they had in their minds. But then you take them to other parts of Hollywood that maybe they haven't grown up with in movies and the rest of it. And, you know, you take them for a meal in Koreatown and they can't believe it's there. And then you go 10 minutes up the road, you know, and again, it's a different version of LA completely. I mean, there's one restaurant where it's a North Korean restaurant, you know. How many places can you go for North Korean cuisine? Apparently, it's not very good, but which, you know, fair enough. But it's in that kind of, and I'm not saying that I'm some kind of purveyor of, you know, obscure LA, but certainly walking around the city, literally hundreds of miles, means that instead of getting in a car where you're almost in a bubble and you kind of float from location A to location B, people will go to work along the same freeway, you know, every day of their lives. Whereas now I find that, you know, friends will say, oh, do I take a left here or is it, you know, the next one? And because you kind of know the lay of the land, you find yourself giving Uber drivers shortcuts and the rest of it. So, yeah, I feel like by now I'm a kind of adopted Angeleno, even though I'm from somewhere else, which I kind of, again, feel is very Angeleno in and of itself.
Well, being a pedestrian in L.A. can be pretty lonely. And your description of Hollywood was fairly scathing. It's brief, but it was scathing. And I can remember one time being in Hollywood. I went to a wasn't a taping, but it's where they do Jeopardy TV shows. And I was trying out for the show, and then I decided, like a genius, to walk back to the Valley. And I walked through Beverly Hills all the way to Van Nuys, and it almost killed me. Mm. That's a long way. I had no idea it was that long.
Yeah, well, I think the scale of LA, the kind of the vastness of it, is something that when you arrive, you realize very quickly that just because of its size, the kind of preconceptions you brought with you can't really apply. It's just too big for that. Mm. And so there is this kind of idea of LA being a place where anything can happen, right? A kind of it's a city where it's. She's almost cunning somehow, you know, as she's going to snatch your soul just like she'd take your money. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of paying for the pleasure of her company while she's telling you whatever you want to hear. But then you get here and you drive along Sunset Boulevard and you go to Griffith Park and you see the Hollywood sign. What you realize is that those things don't really matter, but what's left over, the vast remainder, is shockingly beautiful. And people will tell you that LA is ugly, and sure, it is very ugly in some places, but it is also absolutely gorgeous in others. You're also shocked by the desperation. There's poverty here, but you're not quite ready for the scale of it. And I think that, so you get this kind of weird thing where in one way your preconceptions are kind of ratified, like, yeah, those things are there, but it's just so big. And it stretches up so far beyond those preconceptions that they're also irrelevant. And what that leaves you with is a kind of this enormous city where, you know, I've traveled all over America. I've been fortunate enough now, I think, to travel to 30 states, which isn't bad. And many people have often said, oh, why do you live in L.A.? You know, people are so false there, or it's so ugly, or whatever it might be. And often they'll say this having never been themselves. And so there is this kind of reputation of it, but I always found myself kind of realizing that actually LA, or thinking that actually LA refuses easy definition. You know, you can call it XYZ if you want, and that's fine. But deep down, I kind of feel like, well, you're only partly right. And so now, when I go back to the UK, and people say to me, "Oh, why have you written your sequel in LA? Everybody knows LA." I find myself thinking, you know, they really don't. You know, even Angelinos don't know LA. She kind of refuses to be known.
Mm-hmm. In case you're just tuning in, you've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Nicolas Obregón. We've been talking about his new novel, Sins as Scarlet. It's the second Inspector Iwata novel. And we haven't talked about the bad guy at all, and I don't want to end this interview without talking about the bad guy. You, mm-hmm. We're not going to say anything about who he is, but man, you imagined a really creepy bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of a way to say this without giving too much away. I suppose what I'd say is that the idea of the villain, right, the kind of the almost the rumor of the villain, is always far more sinister than when there's the kind of Scooby-Doo moment and the mask comes off. It's kind of like when you hear the kind of the rumble of thunder at a distance, the kind of the rumor of a storm to come. That's all, in a way, far more kind of sinister than when the storm is actually over your head. And so I tried to create someone who would be dangerous and elusive, but who would also be able to kind of elude Iwata in a way where most murderers wouldn't. And so I knew that by him, by the murderer preying on a segment of society which is overlooked and maligned anyway, he would almost have, in many ways, carte blanche to carry out his bloody project, as it were. But I'm glad you found, I'm glad you found the creepy, because that's certainly what I was going for.
Oh, man, you nailed it. And for readers who love reading mysteries and crime novels in this genre, for that climactic kind of showdown scene near the end, you imagined a pretty spectacular one here. And I don't think any reader is going to go away from that without feeling like they got their money's worth.
You have to give them what they want at the end, as they say.
Yeah. Okay, did I hear you mention the word trilogy earlier? Did that word come out of your mouth?
So the as it stands, I only have a deal for two books in the US.
Uh-huh.
But my UK contract runs to four. So there will be, by hook or by crook, there will be four Inspector Iwata books, unless I have a heart attack or something tomorrow. But touch wood, there will be four Inspector Iwata books out in the world. Where that leads to over here, or indeed in the rest of the world, is anyone's guess. But quite recently, I was speaking to a producer, a kind of a major producer, about a possible adaptation of Sins of Scarlet into a TV series. So whether or not that happens, I mean, it's LA. So as they say, you know, how do you say FU to someone in LA? Do you say trust me? But so we'll see what happens. But they're certainly interested in it. So with any luck, there will be a minimum of four Iwata books in the world, and the third one comes out next year, and it's set in the year 2020. And it's about an English girl is found dead in a love hotel just before the Tokyo Olympics. And so Iwata's called in, and, you know, the commissioner says, I need your old magic type thing. And so once again, he's dragged into the fold.
It's set in 2020?
It's set in 2020, yeah, which just before the Olympics in Tokyo. So that's
okay,
like
well,
the future, but that's only a year and a half away.
So that'll be during the height of the Trump re-election campaign. I did notice you at the very end of the book have Donald Trump. You have like a picture of him on the wall or something. Did you add that right before you sent that in for the final publication?
Well, I knew that, I mean, from kind of early on in the campaign, I knew that this was different, and I knew that I wanted to kind of at least kind of mention it in passing. So it was kind of always present, but in the second draft, when things were kind of clearer, I fleshed it out a little more, because I do remember at the time when he was running, and certainly even leading up to the election, people were laughing. You know, huge TV network pundits were openly laughing, and so I think it's one of those things where, without giving too much away, it was the idea was certainly always there, but it was one of those things where I was like, right, well, I definitely need to rewrite that line now.
Nick, when you heard that these TV people were sniffing around, thinking about maybe doing something with Sins of Scarlet, how did you sleep that night?
Well, quite honestly, it's one of those things where ever since I got an agent, kind of going back 2 or 3 years now, you wake up in the morning and you sort of find yourself at the beginning pinching yourself, but then you wake up in the morning and you try not to think about it too much because it's as if you don't want to jinx it somehow, right? Or you don't want to kind of... So I try, you know, when you get good reviews, just as when you get bad reviews or when this may happen or that may happen, you try and coach yourself to go, well, that's great, but until my name is on a contract and until it's actually happening, I don't want to get my kind of my hopes up. But yeah, certainly, I mean, it is... And this particular producer as well is someone whose shows that are kind of loved all around the world and certainly shows that, I mean, I grew up with loving as well. So it was very, very surreal. But the thing that he said was that he is from L.A., he's kind of born and bred, and when he read this book, he was like, finally, I've picked up a book that's actually about L.A. And so I think it blew his mind a bit that when he met me... that I wasn't like a Mexican kid who was born in L.A., but I was actually like this weird sort of Spanish Englishman who moved here 3 years ago. I think he sort of felt vaguely duped by that. But but yeah, look, it's kind of exceptionally exciting, but at the same time, you kind of try and put it in the freezer until it's actually a thing, because otherwise you go crazy. And hope is the killer, as I say.
Yeah. Well, I think this new book is just... spectacular, and I loved your first book. I loved your debut, Blue Light Yokohama. So for you to put out a second book that is this powerful and so different, I was just thrilled and impressed, and we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you, Vic. It's beautiful to hear you say that, and I so very much appreciate being able to speak to you again a year and a half on. It's lovely. Hopefully we can do that in another year.
Will that be then, if it's been released in the U.S., or will I have to go out and pick up a U.K. copy of that third book?
Yeah, I mean, it should be easy enough to get a hold of.
Okay. Well, in that case, if you're still in L.A., we'll definitely have to reconnect.
Fantastic. Well, Vic, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My guest has been Nicolas Obregón. His book is Sins as Scarlet. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and my guest today was Nicolas Obregón, just starting on what should be a fabulous career as a novelist. His new one, Sins as Scarlet, that's his second book. And last year, I had Louise Penny on the program for the first time for her 13th novel in a series featuring Armand Gamache. And tomorrow, tune in at 10:30 Sunday morning, Louise Penny will be returning to the program with a new one called Kingdom of the Blind. And if you read the New York Times this Sunday morning, you might see this book at the top of the list. I have a feeling it's going to be the number one bestseller this week in the New York Times. Here's the setup. In the thick of winter, a peculiar letter arrives, inviting Armand Gamache to an abandoned farmhouse. He discovers that a complete stranger has named him one of the executors of her will. The will is so odd and includes bequests that are so wildly unlikely that Gamache and the others suspect the woman must have been delusional. But what if she was perfectly sane? When a body is found, the terms of the bizarre will suddenly seem less peculiar and far more menacing. But that isn't the only menace Gamache is facing. The investigation into what happened 6 months ago is another menace. The events that led to his suspension has dragged on, and while most of the opioids he allowed to slip through his hands in order to bring down the cartels have been retrieved, there is one devastating exception. Louise Penny returns to the program tomorrow morning at 10:30 to talk about her new one, Kingdom of the Blind. And she is quickly becoming one of my favorite authors to interview. She is so charming and such a delight to talk to, and so erudite and articulate and just absolutely wonderful. I hope you can tune in tomorrow at 10:30 for the Book Nook on your Sunday Book Nook, which comes your way every weekend on WYSO at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, like it did today, and 10:30 on Sunday mornings. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting your public radio station.